From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Do you ever wonder what food critics talk about? What it would be like to be a fly in the wall as they discuss the nuance of tripe, or perhaps lament the disappearance of their favorite danger dog vendor? Or maybe they're talking about mole, in which case it might sound like this.
At the more authentic places, you usually get a choice of chicken that's been cooking for a week or pork spine.
Nice.
Sometimes they'll throw in a kneecap, which has never been my favorite part of the pig.
Yeah, but it's good for your skin with all that collagen.
Yeah, crunchy.
Mmm. I'm drooling right now. I had Venezuelan food for lunch.
Jonathan Gold and Robert Sietsema, two food critics cut from the same cloth. This morning, I thought it'd be fun to give you that fly-on-the-wall experience. So with no further ado, I hand the mic to my compadre, Jonathan Gold.
I'm here with Robert Sietsema, the senior restaurant critic for Eater, longtime critic for The Village Voice, and founder of the concept of the food fanzine with his Down the Hatch, a magazine that he actually wouldn't let me subscribe to.
To my infinite embarrassment.
Why were you turning away subscribers back then?
Because I had to stuff each and every envelope and affix the postage by hand and lick every stamp. That was in the days before self-adhesive postage. And I would get this horrible taste in my mouth from all the stamps. And also I was sending out like 300 and I thought, well, that's about as far as any publication should extend.
It was a wonderful magazine, always doing things like comparing every bagel shop on the north side of 14th Street between 10th Avenue and 6th.
And of course, little did I know then, you were doing some of the same things in Los Angeles.
So your new book, New York in a Dozen Dishes, you know, it's a wonderful document. It's like hanging out in a room with you and, you know, listening to you talk about food. Nobody knows as much about New York food at this point as you do. And of course, you start off with a splendid long essay on the history of pizza in New York.
Including some of our favorite places like Totono's and John's.
Man, I love John's.
Me too. It's still there and they're still delivering coal every morning through the coal scuttle.
You do have some controversial opinions in there. For example, you assert that New York pizza is the very best pizza in the world and you disdain the pizza in Naples.
I actually was one of the first food writers from New York, at least, to go back to Naples. And this is after we had our Naples pizza revival here, whereby some independent operators got wood ovens and started making tiny pizzas and charging $16 or $17 for them, which is completely against the democratic, a lot of people share a big pie kind of aesthetic of New York pizza. And so I went back there to see what the pies were like. And I mean, I was charmed. Although their pies are like tiny and round and damp and they don't even cut them. And if you try to pick up a slice of pizza, it's going to be all over your pants. That's why it was so sad when the New York City mayor was reviled for eating his pizza with a knife and fork. When indeed, if you're in Naples, that's the only way you can eat it.
And the book goes a lot into pastrami. You spend a certain amount of time trying to sort through the history of pastrami.
That's partly because I don't think Katz's was actually serving pastrami when they first opened. They evolved into it. I mean, if you look on the side of the building, it says Wurstfabrik, which means in Yiddish, sausage maker. And if you look at the Nabelwurst, which is something that they sell on a little piece of rye, and it, fantastically garlic sausage. It's plump and salty and delicious. I think that's the kind of thing that they were probably serving at the start. And the pastrami arose allegedly from Romanian immigrants, which is very weird because there just weren't that many Romanian immigrants in New York compared to the Midwest and several other places. But what we did have was Romanian restaurants. That was like a big fad in the early 20th century. And these places kind of had a floor show and they were kind of like all the waiters wore tuxedos and stuff. And it was just – but it was partly tongue-in-cheek, I think. So these places didn't serve pastrami either. I mean, pastrami seemed as Liebling said, to be like a salesman's lunch, eaten in sandwiches, standing up, and that you quickly ran away from.
Exactly.
And I've always been impressed by your grasp of the pastrami scene there in Los Angeles, where it seems to serve many other functions. I mean, here, the pastrami sandwich really has not evolved since it was first invented. But you have, my God, you have pastrami in burritos and pastrami on hamburgers and pastrami with hot dogs. And I'm kind of jealous sometimes.
Well, a lot of that happened in the 20s and 30s when the Mexican community in Boyle Heights and the Jewish community in Boyle Heights were the same. And so there was a certain intermingling of ingredients, which is why you have pastrami burritos and you have pastrami dogs.
Wow, that's the way that corned beef and cabbage supposedly arose, with the Jews living next to the Irish on the Lower East Side.
A lot of people writing about food, especially the kind of food we write about, are stuck on the concept of authenticity, that something has to be done in the exact New York way or the exact LA way or the exact Mexican way or the exact way that it's done in some godforsaken part of Dongbai. But one of the things I've liked about your writing is that I think you're interested even more in the sort of transitions. In your book, you talk about, say, cheb as being a typical New York dish, even though it's probably not served there in anything close to its actual form. And when I mention cheb, I'm talking about West African, I think specifically Senegalese stew that often involves stuffed fish. And I know that's something that you were always looking for up in Harlem and out in Brooklyn.
Yes, that's something that I'd eaten in West Africa when I went there. And I was just – it blew me away. I loved it so much. It reflected all sorts of different historical facts in Africa and geology and everything else. It was a dish that was originally inspired probably by paella, brought to the island of Gore by Iberian mariners in the 16th century. But the Africans have made it their own. It's a dish of red rice that's been flavored with palm oil, with as many vegetables as possible, reflecting the fact that Dakar itself is ringed with vegetable gardens. You know, it's quite different than the rest of the Sub-Sahara. And then they take the tiny fish that they catch in their pirogues and slit them and stuff them with a paste of cilantro, green onions, and garlic, and then fry the fish and then cook the vegetables in the fry oil and then cook the rice and everything that's gone before. And you have this amazing dish that's heaped up in the middle of the tray, and everyone sits around and eats it communally.
Man, does that sound good?
It is just absolutely fantastic.
What were some things that you found out when you were researching the book that you hadn't quite known about before?
I had a bunch of surprises, and one of them was to discover that guinea pigs are even less common than they were when I first ate them. That some dishes come to New York kind of to die rather than flourish. And I had to get a guinea pig for – I didn't buy it at the pet shop, of course, but I had to find a restaurant that served guinea pig in order to complete that chapter. And it was quite an arduous process trying to find one. And I finally found a restaurant in Corona that served it, but they charged me $50 per guinea pig.
Whoa, because it was that place in Park Slope that used to have them. There was that place in Yonkers.
Not anymore.
Wow.
And the ladies that used to sell the spit-cooked kui in Flushing Meadows Park have completely disappeared.
I've never found a place that served kui here, although there was an Arequipa-style place for a while that served rabbit prepared in the manner of kui, a recipe you have in your book, right?
That's right. Yeah, I didn't think people wanted to go to the pet shop and get a kui and cook it up. It is apparently the same animal as the pet shop fur bag.
That's interesting. Are there – have you run into any farms raising them for consumption?
Definitely not here. I wish I could. It would be funny to see the kui cowboys on their little Shetland ponies kind of herding up the tiny animals.
Well, thanks for stopping by, Robert. It's been great talking to you.
And it was a great pleasure talking to you too, Jonathan.
That was LA Times restaurant critic Jonathan Gold and Robert Tsitsima. senior critic at Eater New York and longtime critic for The Village Voice. Robert's new book is New York in a Dozen Dishes. Coming up, the Queen of Meat stops by to talk about vegetables. Chef April Bloomfield is in the studio next.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. April Bloomfield has a reputation for loving meat. At the Spotted Pig and the Breslin in New York, you can find trotters, kidneys, and livers. But her new cookbook puts vegetables at the center of the plate. In A Girl in Her Green, she writes that lamb shoulders and suckling pigs are sort of like action films. You like them, but you don't want to necessarily watch them all the time. The New York-based chef says that these days, nice peas excite her more than a crispy pig's ear. Hi, April.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Such a lovely book.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you grew up in Birmingham, and it's kind of hard to imagine a more urban city. What was your relationship with veg like when you were a child?
You know, Birmingham's the second biggest city in England, so yeah, it's quite urban. But there is some lovely sprawling green countryside just on the outskirts. You know, I had a really great relationship with vegetables growing up. My grandmother specifically was amazing at cooking vegetables and just an amazing cook in general. You know, I grew up eating delicious sweet peas and carrots and lots of brassicas, you know, broccoli and cauliflower and delicious hot buttered cabbage. And, you know, those delicious English Brussels sprouts that you get. You know, I kind of struggled with a bit more of the floral varieties like parsnips. But as I got older, I really kind of came to appreciate those a bit more.
Was working at the River Cafe sort of a deep aha moment for you with vegetables in terms of the Italian aesthetic and techniques?
You know, I think in general, English people have a bad rap when it comes to cooking vegetables. I think a lot of, you know, people overcook them, and I think that's partly true, but it's changing. And I kind of associated the Italian cooking of vegetables. Like, I thought the English and the Italian way of cooking them was very similar. You know, that kind of slow cooking, the enticing of the vegetable flavors and textures. So yeah, I really had this kind of aha moment at the River Cafe, and I really just fell deeply in love with the humble vegetable.
I really love the way you embrace boiling as a technique, because, I mean, when we think about English vegetables or even our grandmothers or great-grandmothers cooking, a lot of times you think of the boiled veg as being sort of the worst part
of... Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, that goes back to that English bad rap, you know. We get bad rap for having overcooked vegetables. But I think the more simple the vegetable is the most delicious. You're really kind of letting the vegetable shine. So for me, a simple boiled, you know, floret of broccoli in the perfect amount of salted water, and then have it come straight out onto the plate where it's all hot and delicious and nicely seasoned. And then maybe just, you know, drizzling a little bit of lemon and sprinkling it with, you know, delicious spicy olive oil is the most wonderful thing.
The most wonderful thing. I'd love to talk about corn a bit. I know that you love doing this large variety, a huge repertoire of corn cookery. Could you talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to get good corn in England. You know, I haven't been living there for many years, but I'm sure it's changed now. But, you know, I just was amazed when I moved to America that how delicious the corn was. I mean, it was actually really sweet. I think the corn that I'd eaten previously in England wasn't that sweet. And so when I came over, it really made sense. You know, it kind of the sweetness. I was like, oh yeah, it's really sweet corn. It's amazing. I love cooking corn. I have an amazing recipe in A Girl and Her Pig, where I make a delicious succotash with you know, the summer abundance of zucchini and corn and fresh, you know, freshly dug onions and lots of tarragon. And it's basically summer on a plate, you know, and it, you kind of just bind it together with a touch of butter and a little bit of cream. And then in my A Girl and Her Greens, I have a recipe for sweet corn ice cream. And basically, that's just, you're just showcasing the sweet corn. And once you make this sweet corn ice cream, I don't think you'll ever make another ice cream again.
Yeah, it's a pretty stunning moment the first time you put sweet corn ice cream into your mouth.
Oh, it's sensual. It's exotic, you know. And if you get really great corn, which you can quite easily in your local green market, and especially in California, you know, it's just all corn, and it's fun. It's a different way of eating corn. You know, you're not nibbling it off the cob, and yeah, it's just very sensual. And I do a little recipe. I kind of step it up a little bit, and I make a little like bourbon caramel, actually, and it's just enough bourbon just to give a little bit of acidity, and a little bit of bitterness from the caramel works really well with the sweetness of the corn.
Okay, so you said one of my favorite words, bitterness. You really have a great appreciation of the bitter of the vegetable kingdom.
Gosh, yeah, I love bitter. I think it can, it can set off a meal and just, you know, kind of give you peaks and troughs. You know, a lot of people don't like bitter, you know, especially children. And I think as you get older, your palate actually starts to crave bitter. And actually, you know, I've come to appreciate it a lot as I've gotten older. So I love all those kind of chicories and chicorias and lots of, you know, puntarelli. I think you guys have that in California, you know, which is that delicious bitter bulb that comes from Italy, actually comes from Rome, but you know, people have started growing it here, and it's really delicious. But cutting that and knowing how to cut some of that bitterness with lemon or vinegar or anchovy, actually, it's a really good way to start introducing bitterness into your kind of repertoire.
How does anchovy cut bitterness?
I think it's something to do with the saltiness. You know, salt and bitter, actually, they kind of balance each other out, and actually acidity too. Say you get some chicory and you cook it, maybe you braise it or you just want to eat it raw. Really just squeeze a good dose of lemon and maybe drizzle some olive oil and a pinch of salt. And you'll see how it really just kind of makes it balanced.
I think it's really hard to have this conversation with you during summer and not at least refer to the tomato. Is right.
Yeah, delicious.
Delicious.
I love tomato. I love food in general. It brings me so much pleasure. There's nothing more amazing on a hot summer's day when you're pulling some tomatoes out of the fridge and you've just got some spring onions and you slice it up and you douse it in a little bit of vinegar and some salt and olive oil and then sprinkle some lovely, luscious goat cheese, feta cheese or cow's feta cheese over the top. You know, it's basically summer on a plate.
Thank you so much, April.
Oh, it's a pleasure, yeah. I bet you're hungry now, aren't you? I'm starving.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Awesome, thank you.
That was April Bloomfield. She has restaurants in New York and San Francisco, including the Spotted Pig in the Breslin. Her new book is A Girl and Her Greens. We've got a recipe for you on our blog. You hear market manager Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market every week. But did you know that Laura personally visits each and every farm that sells at the Santa Monica Market? This week, she takes us on the road with her to one of her more unusual farm visits.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I happen to be down right now in Carlsbad, California, at a beautiful lagoon, which is the site of Carlsbad Aqua Farm, which is an extraordinarily interesting coastal shellfish farm. I'm talking with Tom Grimm. He's the owner and CEO of Carlsbad Aqua Farm. Tom, you have just repurposed, recreated this whole lagoon into a sustainable shellfish growing oasis. Can you describe a little bit about what's going on right here, right now?
Well, the lagoon was created in its current form through the work and engineering of San Diego Gas and Electric and then supported afterwards by NRG, which operates the Cabrillo Power Station, which is adjacent to the to our farm. What they do is, having shaped this watershed into a more contained lagoon, they draw out about 600 to 700 million gallons of water a day to cool their steam turbines at their plant, which then are discharged out into the ocean. So what that creates for us is basically a river of fresh seawater that flows through here continuously. And that creates the optimal conditions to grow shellfish. And so what we do, we have crops of Pacific oysters and Mediterranean blue mussels. And these two crops are grown in two different ways, but they both are grown in the ocean. And the flow of nutrients and fresh seawater every day creates the optimal growing conditions. And so we breed oysters, and we also spawn mussels and then tend to their larvae as they mature into what they call spat, if they're an oyster, and eventually become the juveniles and adults.
Tom, how long does it take for a little oyster to grow to maturity when it can be harvested?
If you're starting from scratch, so to speak, from the point of spawning, here in Carlsbad, it takes about a year to, sometimes as long as 18 months, but generally about a year. And each stage along the way, the oyster is transforming itself from its earlier villager stage to the mature product that you see in a seafood market or a restaurant.
A lot of people think that farmed seafood of any kind is not good for the environment, but just from what I've seen here and what you're describing, you're not really impacting the environment in a negative way at all here.
Well, there's different kinds of aquaculture. In the case of seafood as it relates to shellfish, well over 95% of it is farmed. It's different than growing fish in pens. We don't feed the oysters or larvae anything when they're out growing in the general growth cycle, just when they first hatch out. But they're filtering the water. And as they filter the water, they make it cleaner. So each shellfish filters 50 gallons a day. So you can imagine what that means if you're growing several million shellfish. That's you know, in our case, 500 to 600 million gallons of seawater are filtered every single day. So we make the ocean much cleaner in our case.
And what they're filtering out, it's not that then the animal, the shellfish, takes any kind of toxin within its body. It's filtering it, but it's also cleaning itself.
Well, the thing that they filter out is microalgae. That's their food. But if you have, let's say, excess amounts of phosphorus or nitrogen from agriculture, or just have a lot of algae in your particular water body, if you don't have a normal healthy ecosystem, which includes shellfish, the algae build up and get thicker and goopier and eventually start to create dead zones. And it becomes what they call eutrophication, which means that the entire pond starts to die or the water body starts to lose its oxygen. So these keep the natural healthy life of a lagoon or an embayment much, much healthier.
Ocean acidification is something everybody hears about as affecting all sorts of creatures in the sea. Can you talk a little bit about that, Tom?
I can. What's happening throughout the whole world ocean is a growing problem of ocean acidification, which is caused when you have more and more CO2 in the atmosphere, which people are familiar with from the burning of fossil fuels. That CO2, when it interacts with the ocean, creates carbonic acid, which makes the ocean pH drop a little bit. It doesn't really affect people at all. Unless they eat shellfish, because the shellfish, when they're babies, when they're larvae, at a very delicate stage, have to build a shell from just about nothing. And so with a little bit more acid in the water, that calcium carbonate, which is their shell, gets dissolved. So they can't survive as well, and their mortality rate is much greater. Here in California, we have a very special kind of an opportunity, because as you go further north along the Pacific coast, where the water's cooler, the ocean acidification challenges are a little bit greater because colder water holds more CO2, and as a result of that, more carbonic acid, et cetera. Here in Carlsbad, we have this very rapid flow of healthy nutrients, not the same temperature issues, and not the same pH issues to the degree they have in other parts of the Pacific coast. So through a lot of studies that have been done by USC and others, they found out that the fastest growing shellfish in the Western Hemisphere, for that matter, in Carlsbad. It's an amazing spot. So what we're doing is building a hatchery here to help grow seed to fill the void, because there isn't that much seed out there for oyster farmers anywhere.
How long is this farm going to be here?
We hope it's going to be here forever. I mean, it's been here in one form or another. They've been doing aquaculture here for over 50 years. It's becoming a real historic part of the working waterfront story of California. So we're the only working waterfront shellfish farm in Southern California, and we hope to be around here for a long time.
And Tom, you and I are hatching a plan to get the Carlsbad Aqua Farm shellfish back in the Santa Monica market. So that'll be something we'll work on toward the late summer.
We can't wait to get back into the Santa Monica Farmers Market. We love it. It's the best in the country, and we'd be delighted to be a small little part of a beautiful program that you have there, Laura.
We've really missed that oyster bar. Thanks, Tom. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find oysters and mussels from Carlsbad Aqua Farm at local Whole Foods and at Santa Monica Seafood. They'll be returning to the Santa Monica Farmers Market in the coming months. We've got more seafood in a minute. We'll talk to a chef from Martha's Vineyard, where it's all about fresh seafood and local produce. Stay with us.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. My culinary sense of place resides in a culture I wasn't born into, and it exists in a country far, far away from my everyday life. What's it like to be deeply part of the land where you live, to have the culinary reflect history that's in your own DNA? For many Americans, this is an elusive dream, but for Chris Fisher of Beetlebung Farm in Martha's Vineyard, it's everyday life. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
So you come from this family that goes back extraordinarily far, not only in America, but on the vineyard.
Yeah, my first ancestor to reside in Martha's Vineyard moved there around 1660. And I was just telling somebody yesterday, they were very fertile people, apparently, because they had 10 children. And I think those children had 10 more and 10 more. And after about 100 years, they were the largest family on the island, which was great for many reasons, but it meant that we didn't have very much land because every generation sort of split it off more. So that's why Beetlebung Farm also holds a lot of value to our family, because we finally, my grandfather worked his whole life on other people's land to finally get his own.
And was the family historically in farming?
Yeah, I think anybody that lived on Martha's Vineyard for as long as my family did, you're on an island. It's 7 miles off the coast of Cape Cod. The environment is so rich with food from the ocean, from the woods. The soil is very fertile. So, you know, without modern day amenities or transportation or anything like that, you had to be very self-sufficient. So I think it was very, very common to be growing your own food, to be fishing, to be hunting. During the 1700s, there was about 20,000 sheep and 3,000 people that lived there. So you had to take care of yourself.
20,000 sheep. And I understand that the naturally really rocky land was used to create a lot of enclosures.
Yeah, there's beautiful stone walls in Chilmark specifically, the town that I grew up in, they say has about 40 miles of stone walls. And even the town had these sponsored pens around town where runaway animals would be stuck. And there's 3 or 4 of them actually that still exist. I always thought that was funny.
I love that.
Funny public service.
Yeah. So if your animal ran away, you could go to the animal lost and found.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it was quite popular.
That's amazingly charming, as is sort of most things on Martha's Vineyard to outsiders. There seems to be this seamless aesthetic that's made from sort of well-used tools and beautiful food set against this incredible landscape. It's like the template for Instagram.
That's a good point. I always wondered why one day I had so many Instagram followers. My grandfather was very, very frugal, as he needed to be as a farmer. And every weekend when we went to the dump, I mean, we would unload the truck and then as soon as I was unloaded, he would already start be putting things back into the truck, and we would come home with more stuff than we had left with. And also, we were driving once, and he stopped a guy working on the side of the road and was like, got out with his cane. I think he was like 95 at the time. And he said, come with me. And he said, you guys moved your dumpster at the phone company, and I need to know where the new one is. And I think they had done so because they'd seen this old man like climbing into the dumpster to get old telephone wires to build trellises with. And I still use what I have left of his dumpster diving.
Was Martha's Vineyard actually Martha's Vineyard?
Martha's Vineyard is named because a captain named Gosnold, I can't remember his first name, had a daughter named Martha. And he was one of the first people to discover or come to the vineyard during the European expansion. And he had, when he saw it for the first time, it was covered in wild grapes. And so he just related it to a vineyard, assuming that they must be making wine there.
Oh, that's really lovely.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about you and cooking. The book is really lovely because the food definitely expresses this intense sense of place, and it's the kind of food that we all want to eat and that we definitely want to share. I'm wondering if you could describe the crack rice.
The idea came from taking bay scallops, which are so beautiful and so incredibly fresh. I mean, you can get them on the vineyard a variety of ways, but when they're still alive and pulsating in your hand when you've shucked them, it's like the best thing in the world. So, but they're very expensive. I've seen them in stores for $35 a pound, or probably even more sometimes, depending on the season. So we came up with a recipe that is meant to be light, meant to be frugal, because you can use, you know, a quarter of a pound of scallops or less, I mean, depending on many people you're serving. And yeah, it's a creative dish that has some brightness in the coriander seeds or cilantro, depending what you have access to. The rice can be leftover rice from the night before. There's a little heat, there's a little acid, and the scallops are sliced very thinly and sautéed. And they just give a body to this dish that's just a really satisfying, healthy dish that you can really celebrate the flavor of those scallops but not break the bank doing so.
Chris, thank you so much. It's a really charming book, and it's a book that I'm going to enjoy for a long time to come.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Chris Fisher. His new book is The Beetlebung Farm Cookbook. We've got a recipe for that crack rice with bay scallops on the Good Food blog. California is a hotbed of craft beer. With Beer Week upon us here in Los Angeles, I wanted to invite Jolie Myers in for a conversation. Jolie's known here at KCRW as the executive producer of Press Play with Madeline Brand, but she's also a self-described beer nerd who covers the LA beer scene for Liquid LA. Hello there.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This is so much fun.
I'm so excited.
So talk about Beer Week a little bit. It actually starts today, correct?
It kicks off today, yes. So there is the big kickoff celebration at Exposition Park. And if you want to just get a cross-section of anything that you can find in LA, head over to Exposition Park, try the beers. There's a wide variety of things that you can try there. It's fun. Everybody's excited. So that's going on today.
And then the whole idea of it going on for a week, there mm-hmm. must be a lot of different events.
Of course. It's saturation point. Basically, everyone's going to be waking up with a headache every single day this week. There's tons of fun stuff. Most of the finer beer bars have really cool tap takeovers, which is when a brewery comes in and you can get their rare stuff. You can get their not so rare stuff. The brewers will be there to tell you about the beers. Some of the more exciting of these events, I would say, is there's a really amazing tap takeover at Library Ale House. It's Smog City, which is down in Torrance. They're one of these great breweries that can do anything from sours to Belgian beers to West Coast IPAs. So they're trotting out some of their really, really rare stuff.
So there's so much to talk about, but mm-hmm. I think one thing I've always wondered is, why is the South Bay such a total hotspot yeah. for beer?
It's incredible. So not only is it the capital in Los Angeles of beer, I would say that it's actually becoming a capital of beer in America. There is some incredible brews coming out of there. I talked about Smog City. They're based there. You have Monkish, which is, they focus on Belgian brews. They do an amazing job. So they're based there. The Dudes, Strand, Red Car, the list goes on. There's also Phantom Carriage is my favorite brewery down there. They make sours and farmhouse ales, and they are unbelievable. So as for why all of these great breweries are setting up shop down in Torrance, first of all, it's easy to set up in the South Bay. These are communities that are outside of the city of Los Angeles. They're outside of the jurisdiction of the county officials. The process for getting licenses, it's much less onerous in the South Bay. So you have things where, you know, let's take Eagle Rock Brewery up in Glassell Park, for instance. It took them over a year to get licensed to set up. And the whole process of licensing from when they began, it's cost them almost $20,000. But when you look at the process in a place like Torrance, for instance, it's going to cost you about $3,000 to get all of the licenses. And the process takes about 8 weeks.
That is insane.
Right. So it's basically a story of, you know, government craziness.
It's so funny. I always just thought it was a story of surfing dudes.
Well, there is literally the brewery called The Dudes, which is hilarious. So yes, there is a beer culture there already.
So when you were mentioning some of the South Bay brewers, you mentioned Phantom Carriage. Mm, mm-hmm. And I understand that they're involved in a really exciting collaboration and that, in fact, collaboration is kind of a hallmark of what's going on today within the craft brewery scene.
Yeah, let me take this Phantom Carriage collaboration. It's very exciting for LA beer in general, but can I just say that I'm really excited about it? So they're collaborating with a brewery called Cascade. They're based up in Portland, Oregon, another huge beer city. And Cascade is famous for their incredible sours. So they have these sour beers that mostly are fruited. So they have like a really amazing creek. They have something called Black Cap Raspberry, which is one of the best beers I've ever had, let alone sour beers. Phantom Carriage is a very local brewery. It opened earlier this year, maybe a little late last year. And the fact that Cascade, which is a world-class brewer of sours, has singled out Phantom Carriage to do a collaboration with, that's a vote of confidence for Phantom Carriage. And that just symbolizes what's happening in LA overall. Our breweries, they're local, but these beers are becoming world-class. And I think that's really interesting.
There is also another element that seems to be really taking on steam, and that's women in beer, which just makes me so happy.
Ooh. Yes, me too. You know, as a feminist, as a beer writer, as a beer nerd, there is a bit of a valley here in between feminism and beer. And it's not that beer isn't a safe place for women. It's just been the purview of men and male brewers and male executives for as long as there's been beer. So what you're seeing in LA right now is a surge in women in beer, which I think is amazing. So you have a brewery called Three Weavers, which is in Inglewood. So Lynn Weaver is the weaver of the name. She owns it. The head brewer is a woman named Alexandra Noel, who is world-renowned for her brews, and they are making some of the best beer in Los Angeles right now. It is very rare to see a brewery that's both woman-owned and operated. So they're blazing a trail there, and I think it's pretty incredible.
Who's the third weaver?
So the three weavers of the name are Lynn and her daughters. So those are the three weavers. You also have Arts District Brewing, which hasn't opened yet, but it's under construction. They just hired Devin Randall from Pizza Port down in the San Diego area to come up and be their head brewer as well. So you're seeing women reaching the top echelons of brewing here. I will share an anecdote with you, though, that infuriates me every time I think about it, but while Three Weavers is making some of the best beer in Los Angeles, just yesterday I heard a supplier refer to them as Three Beavers, which is entirely inappropriate and really horrible. And if that was led by men, nobody would have said it. And so, yeah, sure, have a laugh. But it kind of shows something bigger going on there.
hey, it's always there.
It's always there.
That's why we're having this conversation, right?
Absolutely.
And then just in terms of the number of new breweries ready to come online within the city, how many are there?
A million, bajillion. It is exploding right now. I can't give you an exact answer on that, but you have different nodes of brewing like we talked about with the South Bay. So you have a new brewery that's coming online soon there, but you had Absolution Brewing, which just opened up down there as well. The Arts District, as I mentioned, they have three breweries that are sprouting up right now, and these are enormous operations. You think of the Arts District, these are giant warehouses. So these are places that are going from zero to beer lords in, like, months. You also have Brewery West down in San Pedro, which has been making beer without a home for years now. Their home is expected to open this summer down in San Pedro, which is really exciting. They make some of the best Belgians in the region.
Jolie, what a pleasure.
It is so fun. I'm so happy to share this with you.
And you only had to just walk down the hall.
That's exactly right.
That was Jolie Myers. She is the executive producer of Press Play with Madeline Brand. But as you heard, she has pretty sterling beer credentials. She covers the Los Angeles beer scene for Liquid LA. Wants to see the world's largest Pyrex measuring cup? I do. The company's on tour celebrating its 100th anniversary with an oversized model of the popular cookware. Coming up, we'll hear all about how America's favorite glassware came to be.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. My guess is that you have at least one Pyrex measuring cup in your cupboard. Or if you're like me, you have pie plates. So many pie plates. My childhood kitchen was curated by Corning Glass, the original makers of Pyrex cookware. So I was especially thrilled to learn of a new exhibition at the Corning Museum of Glass. Tina Oldknow is the senior curator at the museum, and she joins me on the line to talk about America's favorite dish, celebrating a century of Pyrex. Hi, Tina.
Hey, hi.
What was the original foundational business of Corning?
Corning began its history by making railroad lanterns, the glass globes for railroad lanterns, and also the first light bulbs for Thomas Edison.
Why were the lanterns so important?
The lanterns were important because in the days before computerized signals, all the signalmen were actual people who waved lanterns with lights inside of them at trains, red and green ones, indicating if they could go or they should stay. So they needed to develop a tough glass that could withstand the cold of winter, for example, but also the heat of the flame inside of the globe.
Because it was an actual flame.
Yes.
Yeah, this is well before LED lighting.
Yes, it is. It was actually, there's a kind of glass that became the Pyrex cookwares, was called Non-X glass, and it was developed in 1909.
And Non-X means what?
Non-X means non-expansion or low thermal expansion, and it is the low thermal expansion glasses that are the ones that are the tough ones, the ones that can withstand high heat and extreme cold.
And how did they get into cookware? I know there are many myths. I would love to know the real story.
The real story is a pretty good one. It's mythic itself, actually. A woman, Bessie Littleton, who was the wife of Corning's first head of research and development, his name was Dr. Jesse Littleton. His wife, Bessie, decided that she was going to try baking a cake in a cut-off glass railroad lantern that her husband had brought home. Who knows exactly what led her to do this, but she baked a cake and found that not only was it great to be able to see the food cooking in the glass, but that the cleanup was easy, kind of all the things that you wanted. And this was before most people think. This happened. This actually happened in 1915.
Well, so when Mrs. Littleton first made that experiment, how soon after was it that Pyrex, like the name Pyrex, came onto the scene and was marketed as a line of cookware?
Well, she actually probably made this discovery earlier than 1915, sometime in 1914 or even 1913, because the first line of 12 different products called Pyrex was marketed in 1915. We have the receipt from the first order from Jordan Marsh Department Store in Chicago from March 1915, and the first ads for Pyrex appeared in Ladies' Home Journal in October 1915. So 1915 was the year that Pyrex cookwares were introduced, and that's why we are celebrating the 100th anniversary of that introduction of Pyrex this year in 2015.
What was that first line?
Oh, it contained, we have actual examples in the exhibition, covered casseroles, a loaf pan, a pie plate, an egg dish, several baking dishes, and a custard cup.
And were they clear or were they the opal glass?
No, these were clear, and the really early ones from the 20s, you can tell them because they have the glass has a slight yellow tinge to it.
And why was this cookware so revolutionary for the housewife?
Well, one of the vignettes we have in the exhibition shows pie plates, and there is a glass pie plate, a stoneware pie plate, and a tin pie plate. And it's the kind of things that were very, you know, in common use right around that time, 1910, 1915. And when you see those pie plates, you can understand better. It's a kind of a hygienic thing. Glass is so easy to clean. And you can see the actual food kind of cooking inside of it. So you can see if it's something's burning or something like that. So it really was revolutionary at the time, this idea that you could actually see your food cooking.
It must have looked so modern to people's eyes at that time.
It did. You know, at that time, especially in the period between the wars, even after World War I ended, there was a lot of ideas about glass architecture, especially in Germany, these ideas that glass architecture would somehow make you healthier by bringing light into your environment, by bringing color into your environment. So there was a lot of attention given to glass at that time as a material for health and as something very modern.
I mean, I remember when Corningware first started to appear, it was like magic, this idea that you can cook your food in something and serve it in the same dish.
Yes, and even the early Pyrex, there's a wonderful photograph we have of a woman pouring boiling water into a Pyrex pie plate on top of a big ice cube from the 1920s. And that was part of the research that they were doing. It was this whole idea of oven to table. And the first Pyrex dishes were actually quite elegant. Many of them had metal or even silver plated carriers. They were engraved. And then right around the time of the Depression, sales were declining, and Corning kind of changed their focus to become much more mass market. This included changing their production techniques to make them more efficient, moving to more automated production techniques. And then they really went mass market with it. And that's when it really became a kind of a household name.
Thank you so much, Tina.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
Tina Oldknow is a senior curator at the Corning Museum of Glass. We've been talking about their current exhibition, America's Favorite Dish, Celebrating a Century of Pyrex. We've got photos of the dishes in the exhibition on the Good Food blog. If you grew up with those casserole dishes like I did, you will really want to see them. Jonathan Gold is back, this time for his weekly restaurant recommendation. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and today we're off to BS Taqueria in the old Mochica space in downtown LA. The chef is Ray Garcia.
Ray Garcia was at the Fig in a hotel in Santa Monica for years, and It's interesting. I like fig. I think it's fun. I've joked on the show that it seems like they have like a direct pipeline between the Arizona Avenue Farmers Market and the restaurant because everything is like in season to like the micro week. But the food was always like a little bit staid.
So the restaurant where he is now, BS Taqueria, do you finally feel like he's been let loose?
I think he's finally doing food that feels like his food. The other food might have been his food, too. I don't want to, you know, pigeonhole anybody. And it's also important to note that he's opening a restaurant called BS in the old Rivera space, or Broken Spanish in the old Rivera space, sometime later this month. But here he's working with the Taqueria menu, more or less, with, I guess, street food. And so there are tacos made on house-made tortillas that are super thick and puddingy. They crack when you fold them. They might not be perfect taco tortillas, but they taste great and you're sitting down anyway. Things like homemade chorizo with crisp potatoes or carnitas or a wonderful one that's probably something that you can imagine eating as a kid growing up in East Los Angeles. The idea of being American and being Mexican at the same time is like, you know, cube bologna that's been browned in a pan and then served, you know, in a taco with salsa and onions as if it were a traditional taco filling. And it works really nicely. Probably the marquee taco here is the one called Clams and Lardo. And you get the tortillas on a plate and there's a heap of clams. It's garnished with little slivers of fried garlic and it's doused with lardo, but very sort of intensely porky against the clams. And it goes nice with the tortilla. Maybe you put a little hot sauce on it, maybe you don't. And the way that it comes together in your mouth, the sort of, you know, luxurious of the pig fat against the, you know, subtle brininess to the clams, the little bit of crunch. It's a beautiful dish.
So delicious. Is the menu kind of fixed or do they change?
It's a fixed menu. So to begin with, they have things called, they call bolsas, which means they come in little paper sacks. So you can get chicharrones made with chicken skin, if you want fried chicken skin with lemon over it. You can get something called rice and beans, which I actually recommend. It's garbanzo beans that have been crisped a little bit. There's toasted wild rice and some chilies and some onions served in a sack, and you pick it out like a snack with your drinks.
That sounds really delicious.
At this point, I should probably mention that the cocktails are designed by Julian Cox, who's the sort of house cocktail guy for the Chait Empire, but who also did such wonderful drinks for Rivera Mexican-based. And a couple of his drinks here are wonderful too. There's one he calls the Hoja Santa, which I guess is their equivalent of a margarita, which comes with a whole giant Hoja Santa leaf. And Hoja Santa is like a big Mexican herb with sort of licorice-y tone to it, but like folded up and stuck inside the glass. And so you smell the herb when you're drinking the cocktail, which is more or less, you know, tequila and lime. It's a nice experience. It's a good way to drink tequila.
Yum.
And this is probably the place where I should talk about the daily specials.
Oh, yes. Please do.
They're big format dishes meant to serve an entire table. And every day of the week has a different one.
So they're like blue plate specials.
Exactly. My favorite so far has been the they call it the pata verde, but it's not a foot. It's a pork shank. It's a big pork shank in sort of a green salsa that's delicious. Crispy, you tear off bits, you wrap in tortillas. On Sundays, they have carne asojugo, the famous, you know, Guadalajara dish of basically roast beef and bean juice and lots of bacon.
Sounds so rich.
It's really rich. The restaurant that serves it in Guadalajara is fascinating. It's known as the fastest restaurant in the world. So you sit down and they don't ask you what you want. They know what you want. They ask you what size you want. You tell them and it's, boom, it's on the table because there's people like wandering the the restaurant with pots and ladles. It's kind of exciting to be served dinner in 15 seconds. It takes longer here, but it's essentially the same dish.
Time enough for you to have a cocktail.
Yeah. And one thing that you wouldn't expect in a restaurant like this is that there are a lot of things that are vegetarian friendly. He does a torta. It's on the menu as beet torta, and your eyes just go straight by it because you assume that it's going to be beef. But it's not. It's beets. He takes beets and he cooks them like a milanesa, right? He sticks them in a batter and he deep fries them. And they're crispy on the outside and they have that sort of, you know, squishy beet thing on the inside.
What a great idea.
Yeah. Puts it on telera roll. It's a really good sandwich. And there's a really good nopales salad. And one of the better tacos is made with calabacitas, with squash. That's, you know, stewed and served with, you know, lots of cheese and onions and chili. And it's a really delicious taco.
Are there churros?
Are there churros? They're the best churros. I have never had churros like these. They're coated in cinnamon sugar, of course, and they're crisp, but they're completely airy. They like dissolve on your tongue like a cinnamon-flavored holy wafer almost. And they're just spectacular. It comes with a sort of chocolate dipping sauce with chili darabol, but you don't really need it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about BS Taqueria in downtown LA. Text the words, good food, to 69866, and you'll get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Or you can find it on the Good Food restaurant map, which lives on the Good Food blog. Remember that if you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's smartphone apps and everyone else's too. Thanks to everyone who works on Good Food. That's Jillian, Laryl, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.